Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, the weekend edition. Coming up on this edition, there's a twin conspiracy in the National Basketball Association. Also, Venezuelans are struggling to eat. Maybe you've seen some of the protests down there. It's a bad situation. We've got some updates about that. Melanie Phillips exposes Britain's stupor. That's an article from thetrumpet.com we'll be talking about. And record number of teens have been hospitalized for marijuana in Colorado. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, this weekend edition on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Hurgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. Also email us any comments or questions or anything to comments at kpcg.fm. Well, as you guys are well aware, NBA playoffs are in full swing. And occasionally what happens is you get twin brothers both playing in the NBA. It's happened a few times. And one of them got injured in his playoff game. And then the next game he had an incredibly good game. So there's a thought that his twin subbed in for him. I doubt this is true, but it's funny. Marcus Morris denies playing for twin brother Markieff Morris in Wizards-Celtics game 2. They're both NBA guys, but they're on different teams. Markieff Morris severely injured his ankle in Game 1 of the Wizards' second-round series against the Celtics. In Game 2, he excelled. He had 16 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals, and a block. Washington outscored Boston by 10 with him on the court. When he wasn't on the court, they were outscored by 20. So he was very effective in that game. That drastic turnaround has sparked a conspiracy theory that Markieff's twin brother, Marcus, who plays for the Pistons, assumed his identity in Game 2. Probably not, but I thought it was funny.
And if you did see the injury in Game 1, it looked really bad. I mean, the side of his ankle touched the floor, which means that he would have had a severely sprained or broken ankle, or maybe something happened to his knee, and then all of a sudden he's playing in a game 2 days later. That doesn't seem possible.
Yeah. Well, they did say, they claim that they didn't do it, of course, but they said that they used to do it back in like, AAU.
Well, that doesn't really help us get less suspicious.
Where that exact thing happened, where one guy got injured and the other guy put his jersey on and then played for him. They're identical twins. And another reason I thought it was so funny is because my son's doing a book report, and it's a fiction report, whatever. But it's about twin brothers playing football and changing identities. So we've been talking about this over the last couple of days, this book report. And but then here in real life, there's a potential of these twins. It's like that show Parent Trap from years ago, if you remember that, where there's the two twin kids. Anyway, probably didn't happen, but I thought it was funny, and I kind of wish it had happened.
Well, how do you confirm it wasn't the other guy?
I guess you can't, but, I mean, it would be really foolish. I mean, you know, they both have big, huge contracts with different teams. You know, you wouldn't want to do it, but I don't know how you would. I guess you couldn't tell, maybe. I'm not sure if they're, even with identical twins, sometimes people say they can tell the difference based upon mannerisms or something, or personality. So I don't know, but wouldn't that be something? That would be like a perfect movie plot.
Well, it is almost like twins spent their time in the womb together. It is almost like they're the same person in a way. So I think that should be allowed.
They'd have to know the plays, I guess. I don't know. So kind of interesting. What other sports note here? You guys maybe have heard of Lonzo Ball. He's some people think going to be the number one draft pick coming out of college this year, going to the NBA, played at UCLA last year. And a tremendous player. His dad gets a lot of attention for making sort of outlandish comments, saying he could beat Michael Jordan one-on-one and things like that. So anyway, they've developed this clothing company called Big Baller Brand. Sorry, Abraham, I know you wanted that name, but they They've been trying to sell or license their merchandise along with another company like Nike or Adidas or Reebok, and I think all three of them said no thanks. So they are releasing their own shoe. So you know when a player is really good, they get their signature shoe, and the most expensive ones are probably $200, $250 maybe. I don't know. Prices have gone up. Oh, they're shooting the moon. Lonzo Ball reveals his new ZO2 signature shoe made by the Big Baller brand. $495.
Wow.
Are you serious? Who's got that much money to spend on a pair of shoes? The guy better be good.
Really good. Yeah, especially to have shoes that are double the price of LeBron James's shoes or anyone else's.
That's a lot of cash.
And you better have a good lawyer if he's stealing my company name here. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're trying to hit some sort of niche market that wants really, really expensive tennis shoes.
Well, it's kind of a gutsy move to, well, maybe a foolish move to market yourself that much before you're even in the NBA. Because if he's a complete flop, he'll always be remembered for that shoe that never sold anywhere. He probably won't flop, but at the same time, it's still, I think, a big move to put yourself at that level.
Well, even if he's really good, who has that kind of money to spend on a shoe?
Yeah.
You'd always hear years ago, maybe it still happens, kids getting, beat up for their shoes if they had Jordans or something in some neighborhoods. You show up to school wearing a $500 pair of shoes. I mean, come on. You better be really, they better help you be good. I think they look neat. I've seen the pictures of them, but $495. Wow. But on the other hand, I was thinking, Abraham, that if he is a flop and they never make these again, and you do have a pair, they might be kind of like a collector's item.
Yeah, who knows?
So
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, maybe they did make a limited amount of those shoes, and so selling one pair for $495 might have cost it more than all of it to produce all of those shoes. So even if they just sell one pair, they're actually making money off it.
You can also, if that's not enough, if you're like, I want to spend a little more money, you can do that. He's got a few pairs. They're $995
apiece.
Wow. But they come in a clear plastic case. They're signed by Lonzo Ball, and they have like some sort of weird lighting. I guess you put them on your shelf. I don't know. I mean, if he ends up being this legendary guy, that might be something that you want to have, but that's a risk.
Yeah, it's like a rookie card. Like, the value goes up exponentially once they get really good. The same thing could go with those shoes because they're like his entry-level collectibles, so he could be playing something like that maybe.
Who knows?
I have no idea.
Very interesting. So we'll see what happens. Poor kid. It's hard to come into the pros and just go through that process of, okay, this is how you play pro basketball. But when you come in with all this sort of hoopla, you're opening yourself up to quite a bit of razzing from your teammates, and it could make his life more difficult. So we'll see how it goes with him.
His dad also said that he would be a better player than Stephen Curry. So I'm really looking forward to Stephen Curry versus Lonzo Ball to see if there's any sort of vengeance taken there.
Yeah, it's you don't want to come in talking too big, I guess. But anyway, there's news in the real world too. it's crazy that there's that kind of money for people to potentially spend when you have severe problems in other nations. You probably have seen somewhat what's going on in Venezuela, protests and rioting and all that. They're in a really tough spot there. From CNN.com, Venezuela's socialist government, led by President Nicolas Maduro, raised the minimum wage 60% on Sunday. That sounds good, okay? To 200,021 bolivars a month, which is $45 U.S., including food stamps. But when you go to the supermarket, a basket of basic grocery items, including eggs, milk, and fruit, cost about four times the monthly minimum wage, over 700, almost 800,000 bolivars. So that's socialism, huh? I mean, they can't even afford to get groceries. So because of that, they say that food shortages and soaring prices have led to troubling results. Last year, the average Venezuelan living in extreme poverty lost about 19 pounds due to lack of food because they had to skip meals, according to a national poll.
I wonder how many of our brainwashed college students have actually looked into situations like that and seriously considered changing their viewpoints, because that's why Bernie Sanders had so much support in this country. Apparently, because he put the word democratic in front of socialist, it makes the whole system different. But it really is going to be the same outcome if we have someone like that leading in the U.S.
Can you guys think of any successful socialist nations?
The only one would be ones who change from socialism to capitalism.
Yeah.
That's the only ones I can think of. But it's very exactly the same thing happened to the Weimar Republic in between the world wars in Germany. And it's just a symptom of a government controlling things arbitrarily and giving people not having a good supply and demand relationship to where you just can't keep up with what people need and the prices and inflation. So it's just a really good case study for modern socialism, because I think the problem with a lot of old socialist states is they were with very famous dictators. And so if people are just like, well, of course, the United States won't be like that because we don't have a dictatorship. But I think the good, bad thing about Venezuela is that it is more like American society than we think. And so it is a really good case study to see what would happen if we completely did away with our capitalistic ideas.
Well, you bring up a really good point there. I mean, at the end of the day, everything does get down to supply and demand. I mean, they can make the minimum wage whatever they want, but if you don't have enough food to go around, those prices are going to go through the roof. That's just the way it is. If you have plenty of food, it won't be that expensive. You know, so no matter how you try to mess with the numbers, supply and demand, it always comes back to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's why people starve, is because people are forced to farm, or they over-farm the land, or people who aren't farmers are given farmland. The farmers are forced to work in factories, and it just doesn't. That's not how society works. If someone's not good at something, you can't expect them to produce things that can help meet other people's needs. And so that's happened everywhere where socialism has taken root. And the scary thing is we're starting to see symptoms of that in our modern society, especially the UK and the United States, where we don't necessarily have food shortages, but we're having huge debt. And that could lead to us not being able to buy the food we need to sustain our societies.
Really interesting situation there in Venezuela. And, it doesn't get a lot of coverage that I've seen anyway. It's kind of down at the bottom of most websites. But it's a big, big deal there. 19 pounds, losing 19 pounds in a year. That's not a great thing unless you're trying to and you're on a diet or something. But forced loss of weight, that's a difficult thing. Here's an interesting write-up also from CNN.com, and I think this highlights the problem with prisons in the U.S. and probably everywhere. But they talk about Aaron Hernandez. He was the former New England Patriots tight end. He signed a big contract. It looked like things were going great. He got convicted of murder, and then he ended up a life sentence in prison. And then he was accused of two other murders, which he was acquitted of. But still, he still had that one life sentence. And the headline here is Aaron Hernandez's life in prison, fights, blocked doors, and a metal shiv. They say in all, Hernandez racked up about a dozen separate disciplinary offenses between May 2015 and October 2016, including three fist fights, two smoking-related issues, two surprise prison tattoos, which is an odd way to say that. I don't think he was surprised by them, but I think the prison was surprised by them.
Maybe that's a way of torturing. I don't know.
He
sounds terrible.
Well, you know, when you're, I've heard that like Russian prisons in particular, like they put tattoos on themselves. It's sort of their story. Mm. And he had he showed up to court with a tattoo that said lifetime loyalty on his neck, which I guess because he had a life sentence, I'm assuming. Mm. So, and then he had a nearly 6-inch sharpened metal shiv, which of course they use as a weapon in prison. He's the former NFL star, and he had been serving a life sentence since April 2015 when he was convicted of the 2013 killing of Odin Lloyd. He was found hanged. This is Hernandez now. He was found hanged in his cell last month, just days after his acquittal in a separate double homicide. So that's why more details about his life in prison are coming out, because he's now dead. But what it shows, I think, and it highlights, is that, you know, if you have somebody that goes to prison for a life sentence, And you know, they're a murderer anyway, or something like that. You know, what the conditions in those prisons are so bad. What do they expect people to do in there? they're going to fight. They're going to get into trouble. They're going to just get worse and worse. And it just shows, I think, the reason those systems don't work. You're just locking somebody up for years and years. And they have kind of nothing to lose, I guess. And so they just descend into worse and worse behavior.
Yeah, I think that's always the argument between capital punishment and more longer prison sentences, and that is that if someone's can live in a cell for the rest of their life or for a very, very long period of time before parole or without parole, what do you want? What's the point of that punishment? Is it are you punishing them by making them live in those conditions? Is it more humane because they don't die in capital punishment? But I think, like you touch on, it just merely exacerbates the problem that why they're in there in the first place. If someone commits a crime like that, there's obviously huge problems in their life, why they would murder someone or do something like that. And so if you put them in that environment where they're with other criminals, and there's really not much reason for them to change because there's no result from it, besides maybe their own personal belief in something, they usually just descend into worse and worse behavior until they they just destroy who they had any chance of reform in their life. So I think it's always a tough debate, but I think this is a good example of how someone who maybe had a chance to change their life kind of just destroy themselves.
Well, and isn't that the idea or the hope that they're sort of, it's like a two-pronged punishment. Like in one case, or in one of the prongs is, well, they're going to pay for what they did by being locked away. But then the second prong is that, well, but they'll be reformed and they'll be better when they are done with their sentence, if they're ever done with it. Very rarely does that happen. They get worse, usually. Statistics here, one of every 9 individuals in prison in the U.S. is serving a life sentence. More than 159,000 people were serving life sentences back in 2012. That's the last they had the numbers for. And 50,000 of those are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. And so I saw a documentary years ago. It was, I think, on A&E or something, and it was about a woman's prison. And they were just, you know, saying basically that even people that were in there for crimes that weren't maybe as drastic, they changed for the worse when they were in there. They did things in prison you wouldn't do other places because the environment was so destructive and violent and terrible. And so in a lot of cases, they're conditioning them to just, you've got to be a pretty hardened individual to survive that. It definitely is not reforming people, I don't think.
Yeah, what are those people going to be like when they get out if every single day they had to have a shank on them to hopefully fend off an attacker at every turn? I mean, anytime they go to the lunch room or to the shower or to their cell, there could be someone waiting there to attack them, or there's always the possibility of a riot. And then when you get out, it's like, well, if you want something, you might as well take it from somebody else, even if it means taking someone's life as well. That's just what they're dealing with in prison, and it's hard to erase living that way once you get out. So how are we really supposed to expect them to behave any differently?
There are plenty of cases where people can't manage once they get out because they're so used to that environment, and then they'll try to go back. So
right.
No easy solutions there. If you're not, I mean, if you're looking to the Bible, you could find some solutions, but people aren't willing to do that. So there's no easy solutions in man's system anyway. But
yeah, there are some extremes in other countries where it's almost like they're going to a four-star hotel, and they have complete privacy in their own room. No danger, obviously, of some violent interactions with other inmates. They have their own computer and a nice breakfast every morning, and a pretty comfortable way of living. But if you make it that nice, then people wouldn't want to get out of prison. So it's kind of tough to find the balance where you don't want to make it so pleasant in prison that people stay there for the rest of their lives, but you also don't want to make it so horrible that they're a nightmare for everyone else when they're finally released.
Yeah. It's a really an interesting dilemma that people face when they try to think about the prison system. Here's one that's a more lighthearted, a better note from the New York Times. This is taken from a 93-year-old yogi, not Yogi Bear, someone who instructs in yoga. Stretch, hold, and laugh This is a lady, Ronnie Aron. She's 93, and her husband's still alive, too. His name's Hank. He's also 93. They give yoga classes in their basement to people. They've been doing it for about 40 years. She instructs with folksy patter sprinkled with wisecracking delivered in a new yoxy chirp, they say. For her comedic groaners, Miss Arnold blames formative summers spent at Catskills resorts. She says, if I don't tell a joke, call an ambulance because something's wrong. So she's got a couple of funny one-liners, she says here. Anyway, the point being that they do a little bit of stretching, they do a lot of laughing, and it's helped them have a pretty good life. She says she can't have yoga without humor, so she makes it a little bit of a laugh session, too. Both she and her husband are World War II veterans. And they began dating in 1943, and they married a year later. She says, we've been married 73 years, but it's more like 36 and a half because half the time I don't listen to him. Ba-bum-bum. Funny. She says, I served in the Army, but we won anyway. She says, I was stationed overseas on Staten Island. And then she says, me and my two sisters, we all became nurses. With our white uniforms, my mother called us her three milk bottles. So after this yoga class and this laugh session with this 93-year-old lady and her husband, the students, they leave $10 bills on the table for them. Then they go up to the dining room where they have dessert. It would be not be a gathering without the Arons, being coaxed into their vaudeville-style comedy duet in which they trade barbs and flirtations, with Mr. Aron supplying quick interludes on his violin and finishing by singing, How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away? Around the table, Miss Aron reveals the truth. She says, "The yoga is just an excuse for the refreshments afterwards." So anyway, I thought that was kind of a nice story because it highlights the humor. And just the fact that because they're laughing, I think they're enjoying life and they've lived a long time and they've had a good time doing it.
Yeah, well, I think most people when they get older, I've heard probably the one word of advice I've heard from all of them that I've talked to is you have to laugh and find humor in life or else it gets too much and it just makes life a lot better. And so this is just a great example of an older couple doing something they like and sharing it with everyone else. And just contributing to a happy community.
Yeah, she had some really... She's a funny lady. Those are some funny words. Yeah, I served in the war. We won anyway. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program this weekend. It's a new one. The Matthew 24 prophecy. The four horsemen of the apocalypse are some of the most terrifying symbols in the entire Bible. Matthew 24 explains this sobering symbolism. But there is an exciting outcome of the worst suffering in human history. Make sure you listen for that program here. And, of course, you can see it on thetrumpet.com, also television this weekend. Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Coming up as well, also check out thetrumpet.com. President Trump boosts political power of churches. This is something he did just yesterday, I believe. And related to that, who is the modern-day Jeroboam? Also, the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program. Lots going on this weekend here on KPCG and thetrumpet.com. Grant, you've got a write-up from thetrumpet.com. Melanie Phillips exposes Britain's stupor. Really interesting write-up, and she's going to be here at Armstrong Auditorium Sunday evening at 6 p.m.
Yeah, and we're all really excited to hear from her. She's one of the last few voices of common sense over there, and if you include the voices of common sense in America, there still might only be a handful right now. And this article is even from 4 years ago, but it remains as timeless as ever. It's from one of her appearances on BBC TV's Question Time program, and this was also alluded to in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show earlier this week on KPCG, just how she was ridiculed for daring to suggest that Iran was a grave threat to Britain.
Yeah, it's amazing. She's written a new book, Guardian Angel, because she columnist for The Guardian there, and she's talked about just how she's faced so much backlash from just saying things that are really pretty common sense, like Iran being a threat. Yes, they are. Talking about the threats of modern education, the threats of the destruction of the traditional family, and other things like that. And yet people get outraged when she says things that are really pretty common sense.
Exactly. And in this instance, there's video of it embedded within the article. They start booing her. The studio audience starts booing and heckling her. And then, of course, the panel has some vehement disagreements with her as well. Even the conservative mayor of London had disagreements. And if we remember back at, around this time was when there was a British soldier who was slaughtered in the streets of London and with like a machete and a meat cleaver. And right. So these guys were yelling Allah Akbar in the streets there. People just stood around and watched and didn't even stop them. That's an Islamic threat. That's a radical Islamic threat. And even right after something like this happening, people could not handle Melanie Phillips pointing out how Iran is a sponsor of terrorism and how they cannot be negotiated with no matter what. Even in this case, when there was a new president elected at the time, Hassan Rouhani, who is really a radical disguised as a moderate, they thought that because there was a new president, maybe we could negotiate now. Yeah. Even though, of course, every president there is controlled by the Ayatollah.
Yeah, and for those that think about the historical side of it, it's certainly some historical echoes there of Winston Churchill warning about Hitler and warning about the Nazis and getting shouted down because the young people, they knew better. They wouldn't hear it. And I don't know. I mean, part of it's probably that people just want to, they don't want it to be that way. They want it to be a peaceful world where we all just get along. But that's not the world we live in. There are real enemies. You know, nations do have enemies. But it's a time period again in Britain, I guess, and in the U.S. too, where even if you just identify the enemy, you're met with a backlash.
Yeah, and Amelia Phillips is a patriot, make no mistake about it. She's being ridiculed by her own people. Instead of her people pointing out the enemy and acknowledging that nation is ruled by radical leaders who want their messiah to return by wreaking as much havoc as possible, despite them explicitly saying as soon as they get nuclear weapons, they're going to use them. It's somehow inappropriate to point out exactly what Iran's own leaders have said.
Yeah, and that's what's so fascinating about it, is that here in this age where there's a lot of emphasis on intelligence and intelligence gathering and figuring out what people are doing, Iran says they want to destroy America.
It's pretty
obviously
simple.
Britain would be part of that with, you know, just the West in general. You don't have to be real sharp or connected to some deep inside sources to know what they want to do, because they tell us all the time.
Yes, and what's also interesting is Iran is obviously connected with all of these radical Islamic threats around the world because they're the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the whole world. Even if it's not Iran in name, it's usually a proxy of Iran that's carrying out a lot of these attacks. Britain, of all places, should know about the threat because they have really imported Muslims en masse, and that has not worked out well for them. Clearly, the allegiance of those people does not lie with Britain. Those people are hostile against their home country. And even with all the facts, all the evidence, all of the examples piled up in their faces, these British people are still asleep. They won't acknowledge the threat there. And they think somehow there's a way to make peace with people who just viciously hate the West.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because this article was from a few years back, as you said, mm-hmm. but still very timely. Melanie Phillips exposes Britain's stupor. And if you think about the response that she got at the time to calling out Iran as an enemy or a threat to Britain there, how many terror attacks have occurred since that time? Mm. Right there. There have been quite a few.
Oh, yeah.
And, again, you can they talk about ISIS and these other groups, but terrorism all does go back to Iran at some point, whether they're directly, you know, behind it. They are the cause of the terrorist movement. And so you think about the time that's elapsed between when she was talking, she was getting booed and shouted down, and then now, well, was she wrong? What do the fruits say? Or was she right?
She's been proven absolutely right, and yet if the same panel discussion took place today, they'd probably have an even more violent anti-British response to what Melanie Phillips would say. So it just shows no matter how bad things get, it's going to take a lot more for people to actually wake up. The Bible describes Ephraim as a silly dove, and it also talks about how their watchmen are like dumb dogs or dogs who do not bark, even when there's danger staring them right in the face. So the British people are taking the cues of their poor leadership, and then in turn, the poor leadership keeps on getting elected by the British people. So really, it's everybody's fault.
Yeah, it seems like every time there's an attack of some kind, there is sort of this script that's followed where leadership will come out and say, we condemn in the strongest terms, which, what does that mean? I'm not going to do anything about it, so you can condemn it all you want. And then they apologize sort of for, Islam and say, well, it's not, you know, keep in mind now, it's not the religion, this is a radical, like they're spending a time almost apologizing for the terrorists and trying to like make it out like they're just this fringe group. But it just keeps happening over and over again. Instead of the leaders stepping up and saying, okay, this is a problem, let's identify it, and this is how we're going to try to solve it, and we don't hear that.
And it does seem like a lot of that is just sort of a weariness of getting into wars. Now it's almost like our people and the British people are so desperate to avoid war or conflict of any sort where family members die in battle that they're willing to try to reconcile in any way possible. And what that has created is basically a sitting target for Islamists to come in and attack them because they're not doing anything over in the Middle East region to stop them from coming in.
It's definitely a culture clash, and that's probably the big issue there. The West is a very different culture than what you see in the Islamic nations or in Iran, and it's a culture clash. And I think it's been highlighted on the Trumpet Hour and other programs where, you know, all these attacks and the UK doesn't respond really in any way. And they're probably thinking on the terrorist side, they're probably thinking, what's it going to take for you guys to, like, get the point? we want a culture clash here. We want a war of some kind. And we just, in the U.S. and in the West and in the U.K., just want to hide from that and not admit that it is a culture clash.
Well, yeah, I think that's a big problem across countries that embrace multiculturalism. And that is that... your voters are now people who represent different countries around the world. And so if you want to be reelected from a certain powerful electorate, especially in London, where there's large numbers of different groups from the Middle East, you can't say anything that will offend them, or you lose your voting base and you're not going to be in parliament that long. But there's also the liberal ruling caste who... and intellectuals who write all the articles and who have a lot of sway over how you're presented to the public as well. So I think a lot of the stupor is it's controlled by perception. The leaders want to be perceived a certain way so they can get elected. And that's, unfortunately, you sacrifice national security for political correctness when I think a lot of leaders, especially in Great Britain over the years, have advocated stronger action. But they're silenced because of political correctness or, as Grant touched on, war weariness. The British people, when they fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of British soldiers died, but still very small amounts compared to any other war Britain's been in. But the mourning was more so than any other war, in a sense, like the public mourning for it. And so there's just a perfect storm of all these things happening in Britain to where it undercuts the government's ability to act and the people's willingness to support it.
That's from thetrumpet.com. You can read the rest of that. Melanie Phillips exposes Britain's stupor. Melanie Phillips will be here live at Armstrong Auditorium giving a presentation on Sunday. And that's May the 7th. And that'll be at 6 p.m. Central Time. So it's open to the public. You can come on out if you need more details about that. Go to thetrumpet.com. If you're listening online, which we have quite a few listeners, thanks for joining us at kpcg.fm, and you're thinking, I can't get there. Oh, don't worry. You can stream it live. You can find more information about that at thetrumpet.com as well.
And you won't hear any heckling here.
No heckling. That's, probably. It's open to the public.
Not from the whole audience.
No. Yeah. Certainly not. So we're really looking forward to what she has to say. She has some great personal experience of living through this change in the way the media presents things, or accelerated change at least, and the way education teaches and presents their message and so forth. And so it's going to be really interesting. She'll be here, Melanie Phillips at Armstrong Auditorium. You can read the rest of this article at thetrumpet.com. Melanie Phillips exposes Britain's stupor. Grant, thanks for bringing that to our attention.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online there at kpcg.fm, as mentioned, and at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and send us comments to comments@kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. Well, a couple years ago, they legalized marijuana in Colorado. And so we've got a few years to look and see what's happened. Has it been a good thing or a bad thing? And according to this write-up you have, Abraham, from the Daily Mail, it's not been a good thing. Record number of teens hospitalized for pot in Colorado. Rate has quadrupled since the cannabis ground zero state legalized marijuana. It's affecting the teens in a negative way.
Yeah, I think this is interesting because it does show the effects of legalizing a drug. And so in this particular case, emergency room patients under the age of 21, so mostly high school students, they've quadrupled since 2010. And that's when the state legalized the drug for medical purposes. 2014 is when it was made for recreational use. So you could buy it just you didn't have to have a medical condition. There was a surge in cases in 2014 as well when it was instituted there. And more than half the adolescents that have gone to the emergency room had symptoms of a mental illness. So about half of the emergency room cases were people who had a mental illness and they were taking cannabis in some kind of fashion.
Did the cannabis lead to the mental illness? Or, I mean, that's the thought, that it just messed with their minds and it caused some problems?
Well, it sounds like this, they were mentally impaired and they started taking marijuana, and that's about half the cases. Half the cases were just other people taking it for whatever use they wanted.
So in some cases they're saying they had some issue beforehand, and it, certainly the drug didn't help it.
Correct.
And maybe even exacerbated the problem. And in the other half, they didn't have a pre-existing issue and that still caused problems.
Yeah, exactly. The other half, they're just normal kids. They have no medical issues with mental health, but they just overdosed on it. They got sick, or they got sick from doing the marijuana. And so the big debate is for marijuana is the costs and the pros and cons. It can relieve pain. It's mainly used as a painkiller medically for chronic diseases. But then for recreational use, people just like smoking it because of the high you get from it. And so people debate whether it's a good or bad thing. A lot of researchers say that it leads to long-term cognitive impairment if used a lot, especially by teenagers. And that's the main danger for these young people, is that this marijuana, you can buy it anywhere it's legal. You can smoke it in public. It's not it's not illegal like it is in so many other places. And then people as young as 15 and younger are smoking it.
Yeah.
And so the big problem is there is quite a bit of data that shows it leads to your mind becomes permanently impaired. If you're by the age of 15, if you're smoking marijuana on a regular basis, there's a 60% chance you have a 60% chance less of getting a high school diploma.
Right.
So your chances of educational achievement drop drastically because of this drug. And I mean, I know from experience, I had friends who would take it, and it does affect your life in big ways, not just with getting an education, but even your lifestyle, and can lead to a lot of crisis in your life as a young person.
Yeah, and the way it usually works with human nature is that if a person does something and there's not a catastrophic result immediately, people tend to think, oh, it's not a big deal, and not really pay attention to the long-term effects. And, I mean, everybody's seen, either known somebody or, you know, it's even made, they make it into movies and things where, you know, people that are into that, they typically are, you know, just a little bit, what would be the word for it? They're not the go-getters, let's say that. You know, they're just sort of content to just smoke the stuff and not do much else. And so that in and of itself, it just destroys ambition, apparently. I mean, everybody, even, you know, just society in general, that's kind of the reputation that people would have. Related to that, and this is, I never thought we'd mention Miley Cyrus, but this does tie in. There's an article about her where she explains why she decided to stop smoking it. Now, maybe I don't know if she'll keep up with it, but She says, I like to surround myself with people that make me want to get better. It's not, and she says, and I was noticing it's not the people that are stoned. She says, I want to be clear and sharp. And the people that are smoking marijuana, she says, aren't that way. That's Miley Cyrus. Okay, so whatever she's into or not into, that's an interesting point. That's somebody that does it. That is, I don't know if people, you know, young people look up to her or not. I'm sure some do. But as a celebrity. And she says it's those people aren't getting anywhere. They're not ambitious. And so, those are her words, and I thought they were interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, I think anyone who's been around someone who does smoke that, there's a clear lack of mental capacity when you're smoking it. It's just, and it's not an insult against their intelligence. It's just the way it is. That's just a side effect of taking that drug. And there's also a lifestyle associated with it. It's not just the drug. When you take that, when you're into that drug, it affects your life in more ways than one. And there's a whole image and persona that kind of comes with that, which can destroy you as well. And in this particular case in Colorado, about half the minors who came into the emergency room tested positive for other drugs,
yep,
not just marijuana. Right. And that's an important point, too, is that marijuana is just the opening door to a threshold of other addictions. And these other drugs were ethanol, opiates,
ethanol.
Cocaine. Yeah.
Like the gasoline?
Yeah, I guess. Okay. Because you can get high off fumes. So yeah. People, where a store I used to work at, we'd be careful because people would steal Listerine and drink it, and you get a high from Listerine.
I went to middle school with a kid that died from smelling gasoline, pre-ethanol days.
Yeah.
But he died. I remember him because he just sat across from me just a ways down in study hall, and then he wasn't there one day, and yep, killed him. I mean, it happens. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a dangerous game to play, and a lot of kids, if marijuana is available to them, it's, you don't have to look much further to get into harder things.
Right. It's all about breaking down barriers, and it's easier to start with something that's not as detrimental immediately. But then once the barrier is broken down, I mean, there's probably very few people that say, that's my limit. I won't go beyond that. You know, if you break down barriers, usually they just keep falling until it's out of control.
Yeah. Well, I knew a person up in Canada that I worked with, and he worked in oil wells, and he used to take marijuana, and then soon after that he started taking cocaine, because a lot of people do who work in the oil fields, and especially around Fort McMurray, it's infamous for that kind of behavior. And one day he was in the back of his trailer, he was smoking marijuana, doing cocaine, and he just realized, like, what am I doing with my life? Like, he's making lots of money, but he's just
blowing it all.
Yeah, he's ruining his life. So he got off of drugs. He realizes how destructive that whole lifestyle and cycle is.
And some people thankfully do that, and they say, hey, wait a second, I don't want to do this, but many don't, or they can't.
Yeah.
And then it's a lifelong problem. Well, and then they end up, what we talked about earlier, in jail or worse.
Yeah, exactly. It leads to social problems and bad life choices. And what is more, too, if you're a young person, you take those drugs, they destroy your body. Mm-hmm. And at least, even if you do stop them, sometimes you can't recover from them fully to where you can function normally. Another side effect of taking marijuana is cannabinoid hypermesis. I think I said that wrong, but basically it makes you become violently ill from smoking marijuana. And that's also another problem. And it's amazing that there's a chart here on, I encourage you to go look at the article. There's a great chart showing some pretty major problems among high school students across the United States. But just for marijuana, states with the highest drug abuse rates among high school students, this is just for marijuana, there's other problems. D.C., Washington, D.C., 32%.
Wow.
New Mexico, 27. Washington State, 26. Connecticut, 26. And Vermont, 25%. So that's over a quarter of high school students having abuse rates with marijuana.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I mean, and those numbers are only going to go up, because if it's legalized, you know, in certain places, who's going to stop it?
Yeah.
Why would you stop it? Other than, you know, people coming to that point where they realize this is hurting my life. But so it is, and it's really tough too for parents, you know, if you live in one of those states, because you may not want your kids involved in it. I would think most wouldn't, but you know, if they're out there in a society where it's open and available, and it's hard enough when it's not, because like you say, everybody probably grew up knowing some people involved in that. It's high school. That was pretty common. I knew a group of kids that's what they did, you know? So it's always kind of been there maybe in the shadows, but now it's free and clear in some of these areas, or not free, but you know what I mean? So how are you going to keep kids out of it? It's you have to be very diligent as a parent.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting on this chart, there's other binge drinking, cocaine, prescription drugs, other abuses, and a lot of the same states show up on there again because it leads to bad habits. And if we've covered the drug epidemic in America, how many kids learn these habits from their parents? It's probably a higher number than we want to look at. Yep. And so it's becoming a generational problem. And what's worse is that what about these people who are smoking marijuana now, how about their children? How will legislation change in 20 years to where what other drugs will be legalized? And it just, we're seeing the seeds of just one area where America is just unraveling itself.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And you think about a whole generation, just even in terms of politically, a voting base. You know, you people want to think that they're smart enough or they're well-informed enough to vote for the person that's going to help the country. Well, you have a whole generation where it's 30% or more that are out of their minds on drugs, and they're supposed to choose the next leader.
Yeah.
What kind of leader are you going to get?
Well, and if you're someone who, a politician who opposes marijuana legislation, there goes 30% of the millennial vote,
right?
Which is a huge amount. That's at least that amount. So it's becoming an issue where it affects huge political elections, and that's something that shouldn't happen.
Yep, very tough to run on any sort of campaign that's trying to uphold some sort of law. That's from the Daily Mail. Record number of teens hospitalized for pot in Colorado. You have one other historical note for us today. This is, we're going to talk a little bit about the life of Prince Philip. He announced his retirement this week. He's no longer making public appearances, I guess. And so he's up in his 90s, yeah?
95.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that'd be good because someone I think everyone knows, quite a famous man. And I think after going through a lot of problems with this current generation, it's good to look back on a good example. Someone who's had a pretty long life, and he's done a very good job in a very high position that has a lot of pressure. And so I thought it'd be just really interesting to go back, see his life, how he helped the Queen, and there's some really good examples he leaves behind for us as he's getting older. And so it's interesting, he was born in Greece. Was born into the royal family of Greece and Denmark. Those countries were united in marriage to each other. They had the same ruling family. And he was born in 1921. And in 1922, there was a revolution in Greece. And so the king had to abdicate and he had to leave. So Prince Philip, as a baby, he had his country was fleeing Greece. The British took them to France. And so he's always been in exile there because of the political upheaval. So he lived in France. He was educated there in Germany, France, and Great Britain. And as a young man approaching World War II, he joined the Royal Navy. And he served quite well in the different battles in the Pacific, in the Mediterranean. He helped the operation in Sicily. He was in Tokyo Bay when the Japanese surrendered to General MacArthur. So he was in a pretty big moments in history, and it's just a good reminder, too, that a lot of sons, he wasn't the only one, but a lot of royalty fought in that war and shared the dangers that normal men did as well. And so he has that perspective of fighting with normal men, and so he knows the sacrifices it takes to keep our country safe.
Yeah, that's amazing to think about just some of the life experiences that he's had. And then you wonder how he feels about the current generation, considering his lifelong experiences.
Yeah, what's nice about Prince Philip is he's more outspoken, maybe more than he should at some times, because the monarchy is supposed to keep their opinions to themselves.
Yeah.
But I think it's very clear that he is not happy with a lot of the trends socially in Britain, but also just how the West is allowing people like Putin and others just to march wherever they want instead of the West standing up, because he fought against the Nazis and the Japanese, and he knows the sacrifices needed when it goes too far.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting, too, is his brothers-in-law, they fought for Germany during World War II. So he actually fought against his own family during that conflict.
Yeah, there were probably quite a few in that position because, again, they weren't that far removed. If they lived in the U.S. or some of these other nations, they weren't that far removed from Germany and from the families back there. So it was an interesting dilemma for, I think, a lot of people.
Yeah, it's just interesting to think about that, how maybe it wasn't a big difference between to them or wasn't a huge decision. It seemed like a very slight thing of who to fight for. But in the end, it made a huge difference in their lives. And so in 1939, King George VI and Queen Elizabeth toured the Royal Navy College. And the Queen and Earl Mountbatten asked Philip to escort the two daughters, Elizabeth and Margaret. And he was a third cousin and a second cousin to so they were related, but very distant relations.
Right.
But anyway, he was still royalty, and so that's when they met, was on this royal visit. And
the rest is history, as
exactly.
They say.
Yeah, Queen Elizabeth fell in love with Philip, and they got married. And what was interesting is Philip gave up his Greek and Danish royal titles to marry Queen Elizabeth, which I think might not seem like a big deal, but I think he's basically opening a new chapter in his life.
Yeah.
And he even, when she was made queen after her father died, he was, he dedicated his life to serve his queen, and he bowed before her, submitting to her as his queen, even though he's her husband. So it's an awkward arrangement because she is the head of state.
Yeah.
But he's still humble enough to go through it with that ceremony and pledge his allegiance to her.
Yeah, well, it shows certainly a lot of humility on his part, but also how much he respects the British royalty.
Yeah.
And that throne, where he'd do something like that.
Yeah, I think it shows his attitude that he knew it was something special, I think, and that he was willing to sacrifice a lot of things that maybe a lot of normal men would never think of sacrificing.
Yeah, and another great thing I think that shows is just that he respected the office. You know, he obviously knew the woman because they're married, but he respected the office, and he was giving his loyalty to that office, which is an important point because sometimes when it comes to leadership, people are very quick to look at the individual that's there and not look so much at the office, which is the bigger issue.
Yeah, and I think his whole life since then shows that, to where he probably has a lot of opinions. He probably sometimes doesn't always agree with what the queen decides, but in public he always supports her, but been very supportive through a lot of difficult moments in her reign. And I think he's just been a good example of honoring that office and doing everything possible to uphold the royal family. And his main legacy, a lot of commentators have said over the last couple of days, is he helped modernize the monarchy and grow the British people in loyalty towards Queen Elizabeth II, because he is he's good at drawing people in. His gaffes and his outspokenness, it does draw people to him, endear the British people to him. And he helped modernize the monarchy, where he did help the people see that they're just people as well, and that they care for them. And he's done a lot of that through charity work, a lot of personal appearances in public, even into his 90s, as we've seen. And so he's been a great ambassador for Queen Elizabeth II in just helping the British people still love the monarchy to this day, even when Britain itself is not really what it used to be.
Yeah. The older generation is passing, that's for sure. 95, you said?
Yes.
Yeah. Some of the history there of Prince Philip. And so he's retiring, so to speak, from public appearances, probably because of age and that type of thing. But so some interesting history there. Make sure this is for the Key of David program coming up this weekend here on KPCG, the Matthew 24 prophecy. You can listen for that here coming up in just a bit. Also, it's online at thetrumpet.com, where you can watch the video and check your local listings for television stations that you can watch it on this weekend. Matthew 24 prophecy, that's new. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Make sure you listen for that. And if you missed any of this week's programs, again, you can get the archives at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. And also, the Trumpet Hour Weekend Review program coming your way this weekend as well. And make sure you check out thetrumpet.com. Headline today, President Trump boosts political power of churches, which is a kind of interesting executive order yesterday. And related to that, who is the modern-day Jeroboam? That is all at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, thanks for spending some time with us this week. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.